Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Joseph Farrell. I'm honorary professor at neurology at the University of Lisbon, Portugal. I have a special expertise in stroke, vascular cognitive impairment, and complications of COVID-19 vaccines. This week, we will discuss two papers published in European Journal of Neurology. First, a paper on management of patients with neurological diseases considering post-pandemic COVID-related risks and dangers, and after, a paper on from guidelines to clinical practice in care for ischemic stroke patients. For the first paper, I would like to welcome my first guest, Professor Sasha Filipovic. Welcome. He's a research professor at the Institute of Medical Research and head of the Center for Neuroscience and Neuromodulation at the University of Belgrade, Serbia. His special expertise is in neurorehabilitation, neurodegenerative diseases, and cognitive neurology. He has a particular interest in the diagnosis and treatment of cognitive and behavioral symptoms associated with COVID-19. Welcome, Sasha, and thank you for joining us. Dear Sasha, can you tell us briefly what motivated you and your colleagues to write this update EAN consensus statement?
Thank you. Thank you, Jose. And it's good to be here. And I would like to thank for invitation to present the paper, which is effectively a joint effort of a number of professionals from EAN, from various scientific panels, which formed the task force, a COVID task force, formed back in 2020 with the beginning of pandemics. The task force produced the first statement with the recommendations for management during the pandemics. And then as the time went on, the situation changed, of course, and luckily the disease became less severe, and also the pandemic was declared finished. So the situation changed, and there was a requirement for an update of these recommendations, particularly since the virus is still present and the infection is ongoing, but it's much milder, luckily. Nevertheless, certain populations and group of people, with particularly people with chronic neurological conditions, including neurological conditions and diseases, are still vulnerable to various complications from the virus. This needs to be taken care of and recognized. So the new updated recommendations were made to address this change situation and change landscape of the care in that domain.
Thank you. So we will have COVID-19 forever, probably, as an endemic infection. So I choose five topics for our conversation. And the first scenario that where we can meet this problem is that we have a patient with a chronic neurological conditions treated with drugs that modify the immune system, and then he also is infected with COVID-19. For instance, if a patient with a myasthenia has a crisis with a respiratory failure, should he be treated? He's also infected with COVID-19. Should he be treated as usual with steroids, immunoglobulin, and plasmapheresis? What's your opinion?
Yes, that's a very important question, and in practice, and the consensus is that ongoing treatment, particularly in these situations, plasma exchange or intravenous immunoglobulins and steroids, should be continued as required for the treatment of the condition. So either it started to be continued or it's necessary to be started. Of course, necessary precautions regarding to individual situations when there is a certain high risk or contraindications, etc., needs to be taken in account. Generally, neurological diseases requiring intensive care unit admissions, whether it's traumatic brain injuries, ischemic strokes, hemorrhagic strokes, status epilepticus, neurohematological diseases, and similar, they should be managed according to the current practice and according to established guidelines, independently of their infection status. However, of course, the individual situation contraindication needs to be taken account. There is no, it should be added in this context that there is no evidence to suggest that either intravenous immunoglobulins or plasmapheresis or plasma exchange increase the risk of SARS-CoV-2 infection. So this also strengthens this statement that the treatment should continue and be done as necessary to treat the patient's acute problem.
Okay, so do as usual, but be prudent and in some cases individualize your treatment.
Yes.
For instance, if a patient with MS is also infected, is being treated, should he stop, continue, or just avoid some treatments?
In principle, people with chronic neurological conditions should not stop their ongoing treatment during SARS-CoV-2 infection, unless there is some other reason, some other medical condition, and something that the treating physician decides and realizes there is a need of. But in principle, generally, this should not be taken as a rule. Actually, it's opposite. They need to continue for their treatment in order to control their underlying and ongoing neurological condition. For multiple sclerosis specifically, it should be taken care that sphingosine-1 phosphate receptor modulators, such as fingolimod and similar drugs, are associated with an increased risk of respiratory infections. So this should be taken account. But on the other hand, it should be balanced with the fact that cessation of this therapy is associated with a significant risk of flare-ups of disease activity. So this needs to be balanced. Patients or people affected informed about the risk and decision taken then specifically according to the situation risk, weighing the risks and benefits on the individual basis.
Thank you. And so another scenario is that the patient is not infected, but there is an uprise of the infection in the community where he lives, more and more cases. So he is at risk of being infected. So if I diagnose a new patient with MS, should I start in that condition, in that scenario, should I start the medication immediately? Should I, wait until the risk decreases, or that depends on the drug that I'm going to use?
The answer is depending on the drug to be used, but generally for multiple sclerosis, all approved disease-modifying therapies actually can be started as usual without delay and just according to the indications regarding multiple sclerosis situation. The only exemption are CD20 inhibitors and fingolimod. For them, they should be very careful, and the situation again should be really carefully balanced regarding pros and cons.
Thank you. And let's move to the COVID-19 vaccine. Well, we know that these vaccines have some complications. They are exceedingly rare, very rare. But many people is afraid of the vaccines. And do you think this risk is a valid argument to avoid or delay vaccination in patients with chronic neurological disease, or it should be exactly the opposite? They should be vaccinated and early on.
This is really an important also question and very relevant, especially because even during the peak of the pandemics, when there were actually a lot of people dying of the disease, there was still debate and controversial opinions among people whether to vaccinate or not, and there were a lot very strong anti-vaccinating movement. So it's important. Now this is less media exposed and less part of conversation, but it's still a very important issue in treatment of patients with chronic diseases and vulnerable patients. To be really realistic, it is known that there are some mild side effects following vaccination. There are generally non-specific symptoms such as headache, fatigue, myalgias, generalized weakness, etc. But all these symptoms are typically self-limiting and very mild. There are also some serious conditions that can happen within a month after receiving a vaccine, such as demyelinating neurological events or seizures or cerebral venous thrombosis. But these events are really extremely rare. And considering the number of people that have received the vaccine, they are really, really happening rarely, although they received a lot of prominence and attention. On the other hand, the side effects, the complications, the symptoms of the virus infection, the complications of the infection, and the complications that may arise after the infection are much, much more serious and much more frequently happening. So the risks of the infection and getting COVID-19 as disease, as condition, highly outweigh any potential risks from vaccine. This is particularly the case in chronic neurological conditions, and actually the advice is that they are really the people that should be offered vaccines, and that this is the best way to protect them from complications and problems that may arise from the infection. Of course, the national guidance and any changes in the current regulations should be followed. But generally, this seems the best way to protect the people vulnerable, people with chronic neurological conditions, to avoid problems that may arise from COVID virus.
I fully agree, and I think we should fully explain that to our patients. And finally, the last question, last topic. Well, some people is infected by COVID-19 and some develop complaints for months of, you know, fatigue or anxiety or pain. I know you have experience on managing the patients. Do you want to briefly summarize how they should be managed?
Yes. This is an issue that will probably remain with us for a while, because the infections are still happening, and these post-COVID symptoms, sometimes called long COVID, tend to happen even after mild infections. So people do not need to have a serious acute disease following infection. They may even pass it almost unnoticed, but they can develop later on these quite disturbing problems, which in some cases can be really be incapacitating. And a number of epidemiological studies put the prevalence of this problem up to 30, some of them 50% of people infected. So this is a very high number of people that potentially can present these problems. Luckily, in most cases, these symptoms are not too severe, and they tend to be self-limiting. So a lot of these people get out of the problem without even seeking medical attention, just with time. But some people do have serious symptoms. And then when people with these symptoms that may be attributed to COVID-19 approach doctor, then this should be taken really seriously and with understanding. And first, the full diagnostic search for other causes should be done to exclude any other possible conditions. But then when this is done and there is a link, so to say, time realistic link with the infection, then the diagnosis of post-COVID condition should be considered. In which case, these people should be offered help which can be complex. It's not just medication, but other type of support like physiotherapy, occupational therapy, psychological support, and support in social issues, professional integration, financial issues, etc. So it is a complex matter, but it's important to be aware that this problem exists and there is a significant number of people they may be affected by this.
Thank you very much. And I think we are close to the end of this first part of the recording. Thank you, Professor Sasha Filipovic, for this interesting conversation.
Thank you. And before concluding, I just would like to thank my co-first author, Professor Selet Nur Öztürk, who actually we share the first co-authorship, as well as the other members of the EAN COVID Task Force, 17 who were mentioned as authors of this paper, because this work was a result of collective effort. And Selet Nur and I coordinated this work, but actually it's a intellectual contribution of number of people and also number of other contributors from scientific panels across EAN.
Now, as my second guest, I would like to welcome Dr. Charlotte Lenz from Leuven, Belgium. And she is a PhD, was a PhD student because she recently defended a PhD thesis on optimizing care processes for patients with ischemic stroke, focusing on quality improvement, patient-reported experiences, and patient-reported outcomes. Congratulations for that.
Thank you.
Congratulations also for the excellent paper that you are the first author. And welcome, and thanks for joining us today. From the paper, From Guidelines to Clinical Practice in Care for Ischemic Stroke Patients, a Systematic Review and Expert Opinion, can you kind of briefly indicate what are the most innovating features of the paper?
So yes, of course, I can elaborate a little bit more about the most important findings of the paper. We started the paper because we saw in a paper of Yu et al. That they stated that there was a lack of applicability on quality measures for stroke guidelines. And in addition, if we look in the literature for stroke guidelines, we see that there are a lot of guidelines, which may be challenging for healthcare professionals if they want to update their care process, or maybe starting from scratch with a new care process. If they're consulting a document, they don't know if it is a comprehensive document, if it contains all the information, do they have to consult multiple documents? And that's why we thought it was interesting to summarize the different guidelines that are available online in online databases, medical databases, and also to have an expert opinion on it to give a little bit more explanation about applicability. So when you want to improve your quality, which are ideal starting points, which have a consensus across the three domains of applicability, or to which recommendations can there be potential barriers where you can anticipate them with the information from the paper?
Thank you. It's really a very innovating method to approach this topic. So I have selected five questions to structure our conversation today. And I was astonished that the experts have such a very low agreement on the feasibility and validity of the guidelines. Any ideas why they have such a low agreement?
Indeed, there are three domains of applicability, so actionability, feasibility, and validity. There are 34 recommendations of the 48 selected recommendations with consensus on applicability, which is a quite high number. But for feasibility and validity, this was much lower. There are 16 and 15 recommendations, respectively. There are possible explanations, different possible explanations for this lack of agreement. For example, in the domain of feasibility, the limited workforces can be a possible explanations, which may hamper feasibility in the domain of general supportive care, but also logistic limitations, for example, for performing an MRI scan, which is, of course, impossible if you don't have one in your hospital. But there can also be recommendations that are beyond the expertise of a neurologist, for example, the treatment of concomitant diseases or prevention of complications, which can all be possible explanations for the lower feasibility. The lack of agreement in validity suggests that experts are not sure about the impact of the recommendation on both the quality of care and the outcomes of the patients, which may reflect an uncertainty about the evidence from the guidelines for these recommendations, or a difficulty in measuring, because we also defined validity as when you derive an indicator from the recommendation, it measures what it is intended to measure. And when this is not the case, it was also considered as a lack of validity. So possible explanations, but we don't know for sure which is the right one.
Yeah, in fact, there were 7 recommendations where all the experts reach agreement, and so they are very robust recommendations. Can you just for the audience list these 7 recommendations?
So the first one was the use of a stroke unit, which is of course an important contextual recommendation, as it has shown that when you are admitted to a stroke unit in comparison to a neurology ward, your outcomes are better after admission to a stroke unit. The second one was the exclusion of hemorrhage, of course an important recommendation in the diagnosis process to perform your differential diagnosis between ischemic and hemorrhagic stroke. The third one was the administration of intravenous thrombolysis, which is a very effective treatment for stroke patients. But the time of symptom onset can limit this therapeutic option, of course. Cardiac monitoring, as a possible cause of stroke is atrial fibrillation, which can be diagnosed via cardiac monitoring, which is needed after the patient is receiving general supportive care. Non-invasive vascular examination to see if there are any causes of stroke due to the vascular system of the patient. Many stroke patients are also immobile, and therefore deep venous thrombosis prophylaxis was also one of the 7 recommendations with consensus across the 3 domains. And last one was the administration of statins if needed, as of course high cholesterol levels are an important risk factor for stroke. So we think this is also a logic one to add to this core set of 7 recommendations.
Thank you. And there were a few items that are commonly used in treatment of acute stroke that were not in the recommendations. There was no agreement. That was a bit surprising. For instance, antiplatelet treatment immediately after stroke, single or double, was not selected. It can be performed everywhere. Do you have an explanation? Wasn't that surprising for you too?
So indeed, we also found this surprising. The antiplatelet treatment was categorized under antithrombotic therapy in our recommendation set. We didn't make a distinction between the single or the double ones. There was a lack of consensus in the domain of validity. It was rather a close lack. So it had consensus. The consensus score was 73%, which is quite a high score, but not high enough to have consensus, as we defined this as 80%. A possible explanation can be we defined the definition of this recommendation as indeed, as you said, as a treatment option. You can treat patients who are not eligible for thrombectomy of thrombolysis with the antiplatelet treatment. We also provided these definitions to the experts, but maybe there are experts that misinterpreted these recommendations and they more think about secondary prevention. And of course, if you think about validity, this we defined as having direct impact on your quality of care. And with your secondary prevention, you don't see your direct impact. It is beyond the scope of your treatment process. So maybe this can explain indeed the lack of consensus in the domain of validity.
Thrombectomy, which is, in my view, one of the major advances of acute stroke treatment, was also not selected. Obviously, in many hospitals, it cannot be performed, but is just the reason why there was no agreement, or there was any other reasons, in your opinion?
Indeed, we also think that the fact that you can't perform thrombectomy in all the hospitals, you only can perform it when you have a comprehensive stroke center, will be the cause of the lack of consensus in the domain of feasibility, because the recommendation of thrombectomy was mentioned in 14 of the 18 included papers, which represents it is an important step of your care process. It's an important treatment option for stroke patients. So indeed, it is not feasible if you cannot perform it in your own center. It can only be performed in comprehensive stroke centers. So we indeed think that this is the reason for the lack of consensus for this recommendation.
And finally, guidelines tend to be developed and written by authors in universities and in high-income countries and tertiary medical centers. And then they are applied or try to be applied in all kinds of settings in the countries with different resources. And that's always a problem because obviously if you don't have the resources, you cannot apply the guidelines. And I noticed that all the experts that participated were from Western Europe. There's nothing wrong with that. But the question is, do you think these guidelines also apply to Eastern Europe or outside Europe, this agreement? This?
If you would have other experts in your expert panel, it would have another outcome. This is an inherent bias of performing an expert opinion. You have the opinion of the expert you selected, and we selected across different countries, indeed of Western Europe, and with a high expertise in stroke care, but there is indeed a bias. But we think that it must be also applicable in other countries, in, for example, Eastern Europe or in Asia. But it can be of interest if we perform, for example, again, an expert opinion with experts from these countries or from globally, and we compare them with each other and we see if guidelines are indeed, they are developed by high-income countries, but they need to be applied also in low-income countries and in Eastern Europe. So maybe it's kind of interest to see, are our guidelines also applicable for other healthcare settings? And if not, maybe we have to think about it and we have to search for solutions for this, because a stroke is a stroke. If you experience it in Western Europe or in Eastern, you need to be treated according to the guidelines and to the best performing as possible. So it would be an interesting future research to compare different experts' opinion, of course, yes.
Yeah, because most of the strokes occur in low or middle income countries, not in high income countries. Thank you very much, Charlotte. I think it was an interesting conversation, and I think I thank everybody who participated in this recording.
Thank you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.